Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, welcome to another Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Rich Herring, and my guest this week is Graham Linehan. I'm recording this in the Departures Lounge at JFK. I'm flying to New York just so I can record this. I hope you're enjoying it. If you like these podcasts, then you can support us in lots of ways. Did you want proof? That is good advice. All right. This isn't the best guest I've ever had. But have you ever tried to suck your own cock, funny lady, talking over me? Anyway, if you like these, why don't you come and see us recording these live? We're doing more in October and November. Also, we're doing more As It Occurs to Me, which we're recording monthly from September the 11th. Try and remember that date if you can. And the more people who come to see those, the more sketches we can make. So go to leicestersquaretheatre.com and you can buy tickets for all of those As It Occurs to Me. There's six of them. Or any of the other Square Theatre podcasts coming up. Anyway, sit back and enjoy listening to me talk to Graham Linehan in Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Goodbye. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who is currently wondering how old his dental floss is. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much. Hello! Hello! Welcome! Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was on the set of Tron this week. Don't you remember this film Tron? I was on the set of it. Still open and everything. They were just waiting to see if they get another one. And all the men who were driving, they still drive around on those little motorcycles. And the men on that call it Rehelstapa. I don't know if that's going to catch on because they're quite cool. I suddenly realised, I've started, you know, like you go to the, I went to the dentist last week, and every time they go to the dentist, they go, you've got to floss your teeth. You know, I go, and every time I go, yeah, I'll do that. And then I do it for one day, and then I never do it. But you buy some new dental floss every time, and then, you know, I've realised I've got about 10 packs of dental floss in my bathroom cupboard. So I sort of took one of them out rather than buying one. And I've been using it quite well. I've done quite well. I've done about a week of dental flossing. But looking at the dental floss, you know, I don't know what you call it, canister. I don't know what it is, little tub thing. It's all kind of perished, and it can't really... And I kind of think it might be the first one I ever bought of dental floss. I remember getting some from my house when I left home in Cheddar when I was 18. I think it's the same one. So I'm currently using 30-year-old dental floss. And I don't know if that's dangerous. I don't know if it degrades or whether they used asbestos in it in those days. And because I got it from home, I'm wondering, you know, that might was my dad's dental floss, really. What if he was one that he'd had from 30 years before that he bought? I'm thinking, I'll do that every week. So that's kind of weird to think I might be using ancient... I mean, it's probably worth money, isn't it? That's the thing. I'm just, every time I take off a bit of dental floss, that is throwing thousands of pounds for the antique dental floss. This observational material is not going down as well. It's harder than it looks, isn't it? The old man draw stuff. I think it'd be easy. I thought everyone would go, yeah, I identify with that, Rich. They're not using dental floss and having old dental floss in the house. Everyone else is going, no, we floss regularly and get through a pack of dental floss in probably a month and then move on to the next. Interdental brushes, it's the way to go. We're still here in the past, reeling from the people who are listening and watching this are in the future. God knows who your Prime Minister is now, but whether they're from Earth or not. They're moving. The news is moving very quickly, making this a not very topical podcast immediately out of date. But my wife's still very upset about Brexit, and I was actually working late at night, like Graham Linehan would, and I was upstairs and my wife was trying to get some sleep and she texted me saying, I can't sleep, I'm so angry still about Brexit, I can't sleep. So I texted her back and said, lay back and don't think about England. Which I thought was kind of quite witty after, you know, that could be in a dictionary of quotations, that very topical one. It's not often I'm very witty, I come up with about a joke about every 2 years, I would say. As I've discovered going back over my show for I'm doing a best of show this tour, I realise how few jokes I write. Anyway, let's crack straight on. I was going to talk about Adrienne Leadsom saying she's being a mother, she understood how things were, but you know, that's fucked already. I mean, that's fucked from where I wrote that down. That's already not. I wrote that down today, and that's not topical anymore. So imagine how people in go, who's Adrienne Leadsom? People are at home. What's going on? Who's that? There aren't lizards are in charge now. So my guest this week, he is probably best known as Gendarme One in Paris. People are so just thinking and remembering that. Can you remember the sitcom Paris with the Lexi Sale? It's Graham Linehan, ladies and gentlemen. It's Graham Linehan, hopefully. Here he is. No, he's not coming on. There he is. Graham Linehan's brought his coat. Welcome. Sit down, pull up a microphone. It's going to be all kinds of fun. So,
I just said welcome back.
Welcome back.
Because I was on automatic.
And, well, good.
You enjoy might your meal, you too.
So, do you remember being the gendarme one in Paris?
Oh, I do.
Was it? Did people still stop you in the street?
Say, it was kind of like, oh, this is cute. Let's put them in it. And and we came in and we mumbled our lines and walked off. But it was in the days before we realised you can't just write something and hand it in.
Right.
You have to be there all the time and you have to be anal about everything. And so you end up reading out lines that don't really work and not really understanding why. Because they were funny when you originally thought of them.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was, you know, just part of the whole Paris experience.
Because Paris was a Alexis Sale sitcom. You wrote that before Father Ted with Arthur Matthews, yeah. So
it was about an artist in the 1920s. You know, it was just loads of... It was kind of Blackadder, I guess, influenced a little bit. It was historical jokes about cubism or... Actually, was it cubism? It was all that sort of thing. And Alexi, you know, the thing we did with Alexi was that we wrote a part that was too, you know, that kind of worked too much with his reputation, you know. So it was very shouty, and it didn't work in the end. It was just people shouting at each other.
Yeah,
you know. And also, we overwrote by about 10 minutes each show.
Right.
And they would say, you need to cut it down. And we'd be like, oh, no, we don't, you know, because we were at that stage where you think, we're not going to change anything. And then it would go out, and it would be like 10 minutes too long. And they'd say, well, you're going to have to lose 10 minutes in the edit. And we're like, well, what did we lose? So essentially, we lost all the jokes.
Right.
Because the only thing, you had to keep in the plot.
Yes.
So it was loads of people telling each other what was going to happen next. And no jokes. There were jokes, but they were confusing and weird because we'd lost lots of the context. So it was, it didn't go well.
That's interesting. So that's your, I mean, you'd written sketches and stuff for people like Alexi and Smith and Jones. Mm-hmm. And this was your first... step into sitcom, and then that could, you know,
that
could have been the end, though, couldn't it?
Oh, God, yeah, we were so lucky. And it was also Channel 4, you know, because and Channel 4, thank God, weren't frightened by the lack of success. And they just commissioned Father Ted while it was still going out, so...
Did they say, as long as it's not that Paris thing, you can do anything you want?
And we were just, from then on, we were just on it. You know, we cast it, and we were there at every rehearsal, and you know, you put in the work, you know?
Yeah. Do you think that's something that broadcasters aren't as prepared to do now, to give second chances, or do you think they still do give second? I mean,
it depends who they are. I think there's some people who are very frightened of failure, especially in comedy. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of people who don't understand comedy and kind of hate it because they don't understand it. There's a great story. The late Jeffrey Perkins, who produced Father Ted. He was really wonderful. And he was once the head of comedy at BBC. And he said that once he got a memo that was some sort of publicity thing for the BBC, and it said, from the greatest costume dramas all the way down to sitcoms. You know, and he said he once went into a meeting and everybody was discussing how they did, and, you know, they were talking about their viewing figures of whatever it would be at the time. They were big compared to now, but you'd be at 10 million, 11 million. And then he sat down and talked, well, you know, Only Fools and Horses, we got 24 million. And, you know, and he just talked a little bit about that, and then they listened to it and they went, okay. And they just went on to something else. Like, it was just no big thing, you know? And he just, I think he really was unhappy there, you know? I don't know if it's changed, but Shane is in there now and he's lovely.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's lots of nice people there. But I think the system is a little odd now. You used to bring things to a commissioner and they would put it on the TV. Now you bring it to a commissioner and they work with you to prepare it to send to someone who's higher than them, who's kind of, you know, not really personally involved, you know, which is possibly good. I don't know. I don't know if it's leading to better comedy necessarily or better programs necessarily.
It's difficult. It's a weird thing. It's a weird, you know, because when we both started around about the same time, writing stuff about the same time,
and we're nearly exactly the same age.
Yeah, and then it was really like, you know, just, here you go, have a go. This is your money, go off and bring something back. So it's, and I feel that in the past has created lots of amazing comedy. You know, that's how Monty Python was created. And it sort of seems weird that everything's done a bit by committee now, and you're jumping through hoops.
Yeah, yeah, it's really weird. And also the money is terrible. I realised recently I would make more money as a failure in America than I am as a success over here. And it's tempting. You go, okay, I can go over to America. I could think of it like kind of retirement, and go over to America and consistently fail and make a great living. Or I can stay here and consistently do okay and make a terrible living.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, we had to move to Norwich, you know, not just because we wanted to get out of London, although that was part of it, but also because... you know, we couldn't afford a house that was nice enough for... Yeah, that was big enough for me to have an office in there and be away from the family. We were all on top of each other.
Yeah.
And the house prices were just getting crazy. And that's another thing about the past. Like, there was a time when you could come to London. I don't know how you guys are finding it, but you could come to London and live quite cheaply somewhere. And, you know, we were writing sketches and we were writing stuff for radio. We were getting no money, you know, just little dribs and drabs of money. But we were able to survive, you know. I would sell records because I was a music journalist as well.
Yeah.
And all these little things kind of carried us through. And I don't know if that would be possible now.
No, I can't imagine it is, you know.
There's nothing to sell. You can't sell MP3s.
No.
You know, so...
You've got to give everything away. That's the problem.
Yeah,
these days.
Yeah.
You work hard on something and then it's all... Well, when I say work hard in it, you know, I've written down some stuff in this book this afternoon. Then I just come and chat with people. It's good. So
you know what? That's when I promised Richard I wouldn't talk about anything that I would ask to get cut out. But me complaining about money is probably going to be on the back burner. I don't think people. Oh, I think I'll listen to Graham Lenehan complain about how little money he's making. What a relaxing way to spend the afternoon.
It's in. So you. We'll listen to it a little bit. You grew up in just outside of Dublin, or on the outskirts of Dublin?
No, in Dublin.
Dublin, yeah.
Mm. Did Not you in have the city? I wasn't running around in rags and you know, nailing horses to walls.
No. Did you ever visit?
That's what they do. That's what they do. They get bored with a horse, they nail it to a wall. That was a big big phase in Dublin for a while. It didn't end up in the commitments for some reason.
Did you spend much time in the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin?
In the what?
I can't read my own writing, so it might be called something else.
The Chester Beatty
Library. Beatty Library, Chester Beatty Library.
No, I don't know what that is.
Did you ever go to the National Leprechaun Museum in Dublin?
Ah, that's so disappointing, that place.
The real leprechauns.
There's just one.
Yeah. It's dead and pinned up.
Dead. He's decomposing. The body isn't, you know, it's actually unpleasant.
Did you ever go to the National Wax Museum Plus in Dublin?
Is there one?
Which it sounds more interesting. I thought, oh, that's good. It's a museum of wax, like it's going to be the history of wax. But it's like celebrities made out of wax.
Right.
Like it's Madame Tussauds, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of what I assumed it was when you described it.
I was excited.
Oh, what's a wax museum?
Candles? I was booking tickets to go to Dublin to see it until I found out it was just people.
Are you mad?
I love museums.
It's so bad in London. What do you think it's going to be like in Dublin? It's going to be amazing.
It'd be great.
It's going to not look like anyone.
I'd like to see lots of celebrities that I don't really know who they are in wax.
My favourite thing, one of the things that used to obsess me and Arthur, we wrote a few sketches about them, was lookalikes. I'm sure you love it as well.
Yeah, cool.
Like lookalikes, like, you know, they'll have, you know, some guy who looks a bit like, you know, Ray Winston or something. And then they'll have a guy and they'll say, Sherlock Holmes. And it's this guy with a deerstalker hat and he's with a guy who's got a moustache and a bowler hat. And you're like, that's just the spit of him. How did you do that? But then all the rest are like, you would never know if their names weren't on them, who they were supposed to be. And it's really, you can have hours of fun looking at a lookalikes website. I really recommend it.
Well, we used to look at the stage, the back of the stage used to have loads of adverts for lookalikes.
Yeah.
And so that was the newspaper.
So funny.
When we first came to London, we kind of wanted to, we lived in that. It was me, Stuart Lee, and a couple of other people lived in this house in Acton together when you could afford to at £60 a week, I think, we were obsessed with that. But then we were going to start up our own lookalike agency. I looked a bit like Michael J. Fox. Mm. One of our friends looked a bit like Elton John.
Right.
Stu looks like quite a lot of people, so he was quite good for it.
Okay.
But then we were going to go Elton John and Michael J. Fox only available together. if you are looking for Michael J. Fox and Elton John to come to your party together and not interact in any way or have anything worked out. But it was, we used to love that. That was lots of fun.
Some very funny stuff out there.
Happy days.
Those agencies are just gold. We used to, if we ever found a good one, we would try and put them in a sketch. Like there was a guy in Dublin who looked, and I'm not exaggerating, he looked exactly like Harvey Keitel. He looked the spit of him, and to such an extent that me and Arthur, when we saw him in a pub, we would just drink and stare at him. And then one day I kind of made some, I pretended he was in the way or something, so he'd talk to me so I could hear what he said. And it was like this really hardcore Dublin accent. And it was simultaneously, you know, disappointing, but also great. So we wrote this sketch where there is these two people having dinner, you know, and they're just talking to each other, you know, and then we were going to ask this guy, we were going to fly him over and get him in this one sketch, and the waiter brings him over and he goes, "You're Harvey Keitel, sir." And they go, "Thank you very much," and they leave him at the table and he sits down, and then he goes, "So, how's life?" And he goes, "Ah, you know, it's fucking fine, you know." And they go, "Waiter, this Harvey Keitel is Irish." Isn't that a great sketch? Bring me a proper Harvey Keitel.
I don't think we talked about this last time, but it reminds me of the you know, the Father Ted experience guys who are the, they're doing the John Cleese's found out about the Fawlty Towers one now.
Yeah, they
got cross about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's people who go around pretending to be the Father Ted characters.
They wait until you've kind of forgotten about it, and then they kind of sneak one on,
right?
You know, and then you kind of go, "Oh, could you not do that?" And they go, "Oh, sorry, we've already booked the place." You know, you sometimes get letters that go, "Please let us down. We've lost all this," and it's like, just don't do it. Don't keep doing it. It's not like, you know, and the thing is, it's. Would be fine if they did it for charity or even, you know, what's the other thing that would be fine if they did?
For you, gave you some money?
Gave me some money. Yeah.
I haven't got that much, that's what I've heard.
Yeah. But, you know, it just kind of is kind of like, well, you know, people might see that and think it's something to do with us, and it's nothing to do with us.
Well, you absolutely assume it does, because there's people... Using the characters' names and using sort of incidents from...
Someone saying, go on.
Yeah. Using the catchphrases. I mean, it's kind of insane that that can happen. On the last podcast, I couldn't believe that the IT crowd had gone to America without your permission. And you've got a very bad agent, Greg.
It kind of happened again.
Oh, did it? What happened?
Well, we went over, tried to... came up... I've always had this kind of... a view of the American IT crowd. I don't think it's worth taking the IT crowd, going over to the States, and trying to make the same show.
No.
Because I think it will... First of all, there's no history of surreal sitcoms in America. There is, but they're all single camera. They're not multi-camera. The only surreal sitcoms I can remember, you might be able to remember more, are Soap.
Yeah.
And Married with Children.
Okay, yeah.
Those and Married with Children is really broad. You know, so they're the two sitcoms. There's no real the history of American sitcoms is a history of beautiful set design, realistic characters, brilliantly deep characters. Yeah. You know, you look at Cheers, and it's just wonderful. It's so deep and rich. And I thought, and Seinfeld, which is, you know, what the IT crowd was badly trying to copy. You know, but my surreal side just kept coming through. You know what I mean? Because that's my default zone mode. So I thought, well, let's try and make the show that I kind of had in my mind when I started, because I always thought it'd be more like Seinfeld, it'd be more realistic and stuff. And so we'll make that. We'll bring them up from the basement so that rather than this upstairs-downstairs idea, the beautiful people are all around them, you know?
Right,
and I said, we'll have a few more characters. We'll have some, you know, beautiful, handsome guy and a beautiful woman who are really annoying, and they'll provide... conflict, and they'll provide storylines, which were always really hard to get going in the IT crowd, because people had to go down to the fucking basement to say, "Hey, I've just come here casually to start a story." But, like, you know, if it's upstairs, you have more of a flow, and it'll be a different show, it'll be an interesting show. And then I thought, well, how about this? How about we make it not just about the IT crowd, but every person who's not considered worthwhile by the other people in the office, you know, like couriers and, you know, people who are kind of overlooked, you know, and that'll be what it's about.
Yeah.
So I sat there, went there for a week, I worked with these two writers, we got bullet points, every single beat of this story, right? Every single beat. Completely different storyline, completely new characters. Moss and Roy and a dumb boss, and Jen, someone who doesn't know anything about computers, who comes into that world. That was all fine, you know, but everything else was done specifically to fine-tune it so it would work in an American setting, right? Yeah. So I do that, week's work, go home, wasn't paid, go home, about a month later, get a call, "Oh, we're just going to shoot your original script, we're going to do the pilot." I was like, what? And also, we're doing it for Fox. I was like, fuck off. You know, I mean... You know, the thing about Murdoch is, you know, if I can avoid it, I will. And the idea that it's a done deal, and I went, no, it's fucking... It ruined my last Christmas. I was so angry all the time, you know? And they literally were just going to do exactly the same thing that the first pilot did and copy it shot for shot with new actors.
Wow.
You know? It's like, what do you have to do? You
know? Show them the first one. Like, look, we've done this. It didn't work.
It exists.
It might work this time.
Yeah.
You never know. They don't. They're very clever out there in America. They know what they're doing. I'll do this quickly. There isn't there's a website called Dirty Britcom Confessions, in which.
Okay.
Yeah, in which comedy fans reveal their sexual fantasies about comedy personages, mainly British comedians.
Okay.
But there is an international section.
Right.
In which you feature because you're Irish. But so they aren't that good. But there's one. Often these are quite dirty and weird. Okay. Yours are all about how nice and cute you are,
and how they'd
like to kiss you and stuff. So this is the best one. I wonder how you'd feel about this. Graham Linehan is such an adorable goofball.
That's me.
Is that a good start? You're such a goofball.
That's how I describe myself to people.
I just want to kiss him all over while he tells me funny stories. Do you think that could work?
I don't think it would work.
I can try it now.
Yeah.
I can try and kiss you all over, and you see how funny your stories are, and how if you can keep your train of thought.
So I went to America, and then I met the writers.
Well, that's it. So if you're up for that, that's. But we're working on a lot.
That's a really tame sex story.
It really is compared.
I thought you were going to go somewhere far more. I don't know. Oblique and
I would have liked to, but I can only work with what the public give me on that one. So believe me, there have been David Mitchell licking mayonnaise off of my entire body was my favourite one. Still brings back lots of memories. You're working on lots of things all the time, so it's difficult to keep up with you and which ones are going to happen and which ones aren't. So I didn't know about the IT crowd again. You're working with Sharon Horgan and your wife, I think.
On a show about Motherland, which is about new mums, I guess.
Okay.
Or mums who are, I don't know, the kids are toddlers.
Yeah.
We wanted to do something where the kids weren't important.
Yeah.
So we had the idea that every time you heard the kids, it would be like the teacher and Charlie Brown.
Right.
You know? And so they would just be a noise, or you'd just see the tops of their heads.
Yeah.
And of course, then when we got there, it was really hard to do. So, you know, they're in some shots.
Right.
But it's ostensibly about motherhood. I was telling Richard earlier, one of the true stories that the thing we want to do is try and use things that have actually happened. Mm. Because they seem to be, there's something about true stories. I think Seinfeld had a rule in the Larry David years where they had to be true stories.
Yeah.
And one of the things we heard was there was this nanny who was taking care of a baby, and the mum was driving around town one day and she saw the nanny with the baby begging on a corner. It's like, whoa, that's half an hour.
It's good they're doubling their income, aren't they? Maybe more than doubling. It'd be better. They're making more money from the baby than they're making from the mother.
Yeah, maybe their nanny should pay you to take the baby.
They should. If they gave you a cut, it wouldn't be so bad.
Yeah.
They're looking after your kid. They're getting out your hair.
Yeah. And they're earning. They're bringing in the moolah.
And if you've got, you know, they've got a nice kid. It's kind of insulting because it's sort of saying that baby could look like it's a homeless person's baby. Yeah. Do they dirty the baby?
I think it's a cuteness thing.
That a cute baby. She looks very well cared for then. So let's move into some emergency questions.
Already?
Yeah, no, just because they're fun though. It's just, and then because, you know, we just have to mix it up a bit.
Okay.
Have you ever been in the vicinity of a Bigfoot but not seen it? but sense that it's watching you?
No, I haven't, sorry.
You sure?
I can't think of a funny answer either, no.
I mean, it's not really an answer. If it's happened, then that's the answer,
William Gibson said a great thing the other day. He said that camera phones made UFOs disappear and police violence appear.
That is very true. Lots of people have been nicking my emergency questions and
it's a shame, though, isn't it? There's a little bit of sadness about that because, you know, in the old days, like, Even as recently as the 70s.
Yeah.
But like Steven Spielberg made Close Encounters, which I remember when I was a kid was just the most thrilling thing ever. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't really make a film like that now because everyone would just go, well, why isn't it on telly? Why aren't there? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
why don't all these people see it on telly? Why isn't it being filmed on camera phones? There's so much stuff that's like that. That's like, you can't, you know, there was an article online about, you know, something like 100 Seinfeld stories that you couldn't do now.
Yeah, because of, yeah, you just would ring each other up and...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, no, life was, you know, even in the 1990s, if you went to the pub and you were meant to meet someone and you, they didn't turn up...
That was it.
That was the end of the evening.
That was it, yeah. Because I go home, you know, and now
you could,
like,
ring
oh,
them
no,
up.
There's 30 other people in the area.
You could ring them up, leave a message on their answer phone saying, oh, I waited at the pub, you didn't turn up.
Yeah,
give
me
a ring tomorrow and let me know what happened. Yes, we had phones back then.
That's another thing, but it's kind of crazy. That always used to frustrate me when people used to moan about Twitter and Facebook and social networking. I mean, I know they've all got their problems, you know? I mean, Twitter is actually probably poisonous in a lot of different ways, I'm beginning to realise. But the thing that always bugged me was that people weren't interested in admitting that it had completely changed the human race.
Yeah.
It's like, don't you find there's a little kind of bit of wonder in you about the fact that we now are all kind of connected telepathically? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, aren't you at all interested in that? And it was all these people, oh, Twitter's shit, you know? Oh, why don't you try it? Oh, same reason I don't try street mime, you know? Because, you know, I know it's probably shit. And it's like, wow, okay. So no curiosity about this thing that connects every single human being on the planet, you know? I don't know. It's although I wonder, you know, you also think, is all the kind of craziness we're going through at the moment, is that because of
I sort of feel networking? It's like Twitter's, you know, finally gained sentience and come to life and is a beast that is destroying it. Because I think all the politics, I think it comes from reality TV and Twitter and you know, and I think voting for things like the X Factor has changed the way people's minds work with those things. So people can go on Twitter, Donald Trump can come on and just say the opposite of what the truth is.
Yeah, yeah.
Can defend himself saying, I'm the one standing up for, you know, he's been accused of raping a child, but he's going on about Hillary Clinton's emails all the time. No one's going, well, you know, we're going to just go on things that are accusations, actually, Donald, maybe we can
I don't blame Twitter and things for that. I blame you know, the mainstream media, which it's like there's two groups of people now. There's people who are plugged in and know that stuff is happening, bad stuff is happening. And then there's people who are getting their news and information from the usual sources, and they don't know that it's happening. And as a result, you get matters of fact treated like matters of opinion.
Yeah.
You know? So you'll have someone, well, this guy, here's Donald Trump, right? And Donald Trump is saying, Hillary Clinton killed the Beatles, you know? And then, what do you say to that? It's like, no, it's not an argument. She didn't kill the Beatles. You just say, that's a lie. Yeah. That's a big lie. You're lying. You know, and it's like you do that to everyone. They didn't do it on Brexit either, you know.
No, you're
fucking lying. Your dad didn't lose his business gove, you big cunt.
But it works, and it works the other way. It works the other way around. It works the other way around.
I'm not proud of getting a round of applause in the word cunt. Sorry.
I think it works the other way around in that, you know, that people... Oh, what was I going to say? I had a great argument there. I lost my train of thought.
Lies.
Well, no, it works the other way, you know, that people... That conspiracy theories are now just... So, like, you know, I think when the... At the moment, what we're experiencing is the Corbyn versus the rest of the Labour Party. And it just becomes this kind of conspiracy thing. So you're on one side of that and you think... And everyone just goes, oh, that's a conspiracy, or all Labour MPs are Blairites, apart from Corbyn, and, you know, or anything that's in fact a conspiracy theory becomes accepted as real.
Everyone thinks the BBC is biased. Mm-hmm. Every single fucking political group thinks the BBC is biased.
Yeah.
And it's like, they're not biased. It's just because they're not pointing out facts, and as a result, you think they're biased.
Yeah.
But if you point out facts, if you say, like someone said, right-wing news is basically fan fiction.
Yeah.
Right? You know what I mean? It's presenting a view of the world that just does not exist, okay? Whereas news, as it should be, is just facts, you know? And the thing that really annoys right-wingers is that facts are left-wing. No, I'm not the first person to say that. Facts are left-wing. Do you know what I mean? If you increase the amount of information about sex to kids, if you increase the availability of contraception, if you do all this sort of stuff, you will bring down levels of abortion, right? But they don't want to do that because they're more interested in making people, you know, feel bad about themselves. And as a result, you know, the stuff that's been proven is just being ignored. Like, same with drug, what's the word? Legislation, you know? You know, it's the same thing. It's, you know, some countries, and they're doing it, and it's working. But yeah, that will never happen in England, because it's more important to have the appearance of hating these things and just thinking they're, you know, it's just binary.
But
know?
Also,
sorry, I'm boring myself.
It's interesting. I think it creates. I mean, I think it validates you, whatever you think. The internet, it's, you know, whoever you are, whatever you think, whatever perversity you have, it suddenly validates you because you realise there are other people out there like you. So I think the rise of UKIP and the rise of that and the Brexit thing comes from people going, oh, you know, you know, and then maybe that's good or bad, whichever way you look at it. But there's people coming together via that, and then I think that's where it becomes where that turns into reality, and awful things happen where someone does, you know, where awful crimes are committed as a result of people being emboldened by other people agreeing with them online. So it creates those echo chambers, which I don't think is very helpful. That's the problem.
But
you don't hear the other side. And if you try to, you know, today I had an argument, and I don't really know what I think about the Labour Party, but I'm kind of interested in debating it. But if you try and talk to anyone about it, it's just very much like, no, if the I'm all for Corbyn, and it's everyone else is against Corbyn, and Corbyn is great, and everything else is evil. There's no, like, is there any suggestion that it might be bad for the Labour Party?
Absolutely.
No, it's not. You know, so you get into those things, and then you just get frustrated talking to each other because you're not going to change each other's minds.
Yeah, it's not the right place for these things. But I think that a lot of, you know, I would imagine a lot of newspapers, journalists, and broadcast journalists are depressed because they think they're being usurped by all this technology. Whereas, in fact, they're more important than ever because they can present, they can dive down into the facts and they can present the facts to people.
Yeah.
Like, there's a thing on BBC, they have a BBC reality check, and it's a Twitter feed, you know? And I was thinking, only politics nerds will follow this feed.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be on a feed. It should be on the news. This is what happened. This is what he said. This is the truth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Sorry.
Well, I mean, it's incredible. The whole Brexit thing is incredible. The number of lies that, you know, actually, I had an argument with someone saying, well, there were lies on both sides. And I said, well, what are the lies from the... from the Remain side?
Yeah.
And he said, well, David Cameron said there would be World War III if... if we leave. I said,
well,
did
what
he?
Time is
that? I said, and he was going, it hasn't happened yet. That was his. That's what I was saying. Like, things already seem to be going quite bad economically. It would suggest that this was, you know, those economic experts were correct. But, you know, I'm prepared to give it some time and see what happens. But then someone else came in and said, well, actually, what, you know, I think David Cameron made a comment about national security that I think he said that Europe is safer from World War as a result of being together, which is obviously true.
Yeah.
And then the exit people said, David Cameron saying that there'll be World War III. So the guy who was quoting me this fact after I said to him, just come back with one fact. He said, one lie that they've told.
Yeah,
it took him ages. He said, I'm not going to trawl the internet for the time. I'm not asking you to trawl the internet, just find one lie. And then he said, oh, they came back with this. And I said, can you tell me what speech is? I'm not going to go and trawl the internet to find out what speech the thing I've just made up has come from. But it turned out it was a lie from the exit people anyway. So it's, when you're dealing with stuff like that, it was Cameron.
Cameron, so it's slightly different. Well, I mean, I can't get.
Yeah, but he hadn't actually said it, so he hadn't actually lied.
Oh, it was a lie that he said.
It was a lie that the exit people had said that he had talked it up into a lie, and he hadn't ever said anything like
right,
it.
Right, right, right.
He basically said it'd be more peaceful if we.
Again, all you need is a kind of reality check. You know, he said this is true. Like, Trump is just amazing. I mean, Trump, the lies that he's broken through so many barriers of discourse, of political discourse, that it's like, it's almost like a bull has run through a stable and created this huge hole through each part of it, and you're just looking down. Oh, look, you could just walk up there now. And that's what it's going to be like for all these politicians in the future. They're just going to be able to lie, and then they know that the BBC will go, or whatever news channel it is, because the balance thing is everywhere. RTE had to recently apologise for something I did with my wife, because we went over to speak about our experience of fatal fetal abnormality. We had our first pregnancy. We it didn't happen, you know.
Yeah.
And luckily we were in the UK, and the NHS, you know, told us what to do about it. You can't get that in Ireland, you know. And so we talked about it on this show. And RTE had to apologise because there wasn't an opposing view telling us that my wife should have brought the child, born the child for 9 months and then watched it die as soon as it was born. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like balance as a concept has become completely used by the right wing to poison the national conversation. You know?
Yes. No, I think it has. But also because it makes good TV, but also because you sort of think you're getting a balance. You'll take someone, even if you have a balanced thing, it'll be someone from UKIP, it'll be someone from the left of Labour, and maybe one person from the middle.
Yeah.
But if the truth is, most people are somewhere in the middle. Most,
yeah,
you know, say, you know, I'm just making up, but say 70% in the middle, and 15% either side. If every debate you have a UKIP person and a left-wing person, that's massively misrepresenting that view, and then, therefore, you know, the people in the middle, who's most people who I think would like to, you know, that's what I sort of feel with all of this. Most people, even if they voted whichever way they voted in the Leave and Remain thing, would like to, some way of sorting out so everyone's happy.
Well, this is what I don't know whether there's I don't think a second referendum is in any way realistic. I've been following it a little bit, and it seems that it's not. But the thing that really annoys me about the referendum is that it wasn't fought on facts, and as a result, no one really knew what was going to happen. And and you can see this. Like, I never saw a single piece, article about what would... I mean, I'm sure there were some, but they should have been much more spread about. Like, what would happen to Northern Ireland when we left the EU? Because the border's going to go back up, and you're going to have soldiers searching people as they go across the border the same way that you used to. You're going to have a lot of pissed off people in the north who want to be part of Ireland, and there's no more free movement. You're going to have a lot of pissed off people in the south for the same reason, you know? Yeah. And it's crazy that I only saw an article about this after the fucking vote went through.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought about it. I'm Irish and I hadn't even thought about it.
Well, they really got the debate going after it had happened. They really started putting everything...
It kicked up a notch.
It did. And everyone went, oh, God, it would be quite bad if we left. if they give it another chance, let's not vote for that again. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, but also, everyone voted for different things. So lots of people vote. Some people were voting because they want sovereignty, whatever that means, and they believe that we don't have that. Some people were voting because they thought that the immigrants were going to leave. I think they thought leave meant that immigrants leave.
Yeah.
And that's generally definitely the case, at least for some people.
They had those trucks that said go home.
Yeah.
Theresa May had trucks around that said go home. So posters that say leave may well be part of that same campaign.
Yeah. So none of those people are going to get exactly what they want anyway. So now there should be a referendum saying what were you expecting from the leave? Let's have a vote about that. But, you know, no one's actually going to get what they want, you know, I think, from it. So it's a real... I mean, it's such a disaster. Whichever side you're on, it's just awful.
It's interesting that Theresa May has placed herself... Apparently today she said, we've said we're leaving, let's make it work. And I kind of think that might be an opportunity because you need a centrist party who says, fuck you, no, we're going to represent all the people who voted to stay and the people who wish they'd voted to stay.
Yeah.
You know?
And it would be good if that could be set up in time, but, you know, as you see within the Labour Party, that can't even agree between itself what it thinks the Labour Party is. Yeah, so that's a starting point.
I joined Labour because of Corbyn, thinking, oh, this is great, but now I'm beginning to get a bit, well, very nervous with it. Because, I don't know, they seem to be fighting battles of the 70s and 80s. Rather than fighting what's going on now. And people say, well, you know, he's got a Snapchat account. I don't think that makes...
I think the whole country's... You know, we've done a good night, sweetheart, on our country. But we said only Gary Sparrow is staying in the present and everyone else has
gone. Why are you obsessed with good
night, sweetheart? I love sort of time travel stuff, but especially when it's wrong, though, you know. So that's I'm infuriated by it,
right?
And want it to be properly done.
Yeah.
And I like Goodnight Sweetheart. A, because I think it's a missed opportunity, because I think it's really interesting whether if you could travel back in time and know you could have an affair with someone and know you would never be caught, would you feel guilty or would you still feel guilty about it?
Does your wife listen to the podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I wouldn't want to do it, but he's not conflicted in the
my problem is I go back in time and I would have the affair and then I come back and I tell my wife about it because I'd be crying, I'm so sorry.
Well, exactly. He isn't conflicted. He isn't upset about it particularly.
Yeah.
He isn't like going great either. You know? So I think there's a real interesting psychological thing in whether a human being, if they knew they couldn't get caught, would they still feel guilty? And it would depend on the person.
I have a weird recurring dream where it's not the same dream, but I have the same history in the dream.
Right.
And the history in the dream is that I have had an affair.
Right.
So I'm in this dream and I'm going, okay, I've had an affair. So I haven't told Helen about it. Why haven't I told Helen and stuff? And then I wake up and the new reality is like, oh no, I haven't. I have to kind of talk. Have I had an affair? No. You know, and yeah, but it's a really weird thing. It's like I've got a history in a dream.
It is weird when those, because like, sometimes I think, is that just, did I just have a very long dream where it felt like that was, but there were dreams that sort of refer back to other dreams.
Yeah, to past.
And so,
past
and so you sort of believe in the reality of
it. Yeah. Do you remember when you wore the cheese hat?
Well, I once had a dream that as a kid, I'd murdered a small girl and buried her in the hills in Cheddar.
Wow.
And I woke up and I thought, did I do that? I had to really think hard, and then I wonder if I did do it, and and I've repressed it apart from in that. I was a kid as well. It wasn't like I was, you know, so it was a kid killing another kid and then my dad helping me to bury her in the hills. Now, I haven't been caught, have we? This could be the moment. I don't remember any little kids going missing. No. But it was Somerset, you know, people didn't probably know
me
kids.
Have you looked at papers near where you used to live?
But I often have those kind of weird dreams where you...
Yeah, history. Maybe it comes with age. I mean, you're 49, I'm nearly 50. Right. Like 50 next year, but like maybe you.
I'm 48 actually, Graham. I'm 49 tomorrow. Oh, so let's.
Maybe you develop.
Clinging onto.
Maybe you develop a kind of, you know, a kind of parallel history in your dreams. You know, like maybe that's a persistent thing now for you in all the rest of your dreams. Oh yeah, I'm Richard Herring. I'm a comedian. I killed a kid.
Got away with it. And I opened my big mouth. But it was also, this is probably a dream, right? So as long as this is within, I know, if this is within the dream, I'm
that's a great moment. That doesn't happen a lot. But when it does, oh, sorry, did I interrupt you?
No, go.
Sorry, sometimes I'm so tired. I just bliss out. But like, that's a brilliant moment in a dream where you are in terrible trouble and then you realise it's a dream.
Yeah.
That's the best feeling. Oh, God, you know, like you've killed a kid and you're like, oh, I haven't. Oh, phew.
I've had dreams that I've realised it's a dream, but then not been able to wake up and not being able to escape it. And
really?
Then, yeah, I've had lucid dreams occasionally. I had one really long dream that I kept waking up, but then I was still asleep.
Oh, right. My experience with that was kind of pleasant. I've had lucid dreams where I've kind of realised this is a dream. I'll have a look around.
Yeah. Okay, I'll ask you another. This it was good. That emergency question worked very well. I can't remember what it was, but whatever it was.
Interesting that you like. Do you like high concept sitcoms then?
I sort of enjoy them if they don't work as well. I watched Zoolander 2 the other day and it's terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even enjoyable terrible, but as a writer, you watch it and go, I've just finished my second draft of the script that I'm writing, which is about alternate universes, and it's basically Sliding Doors and Goodnight Sweetheart put together, but done properly, hopefully. I'll be very furious with myself if it comes out wrong. But then I watched Zoolander 2 and thought, oh, my script is definitely better than this.
There used to be, when we were first writing comedy, we used to see there was a certain program that kept winning BAFTAs.
Right.
And we used to have what we called the radiator test, which was when I was a kid, but when I was a kid at school, there used to be these radiators during the winter, and you used to, because we were so bored out of our heads, we would sit on these radiators and see how long we could stand it. We used to do the radiator test with this program, with this BAFTA-winning program, you know? And we would last 5 minutes, 10 minutes. We just could not bear the style of comedy, you know? And it was such a great thing. There was always the shows that you wanted to emulate, but also there were these other shows that were winning BAFTAs.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, I can do better than that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, it's sort of interesting with
it's
Hollywood.
It's good to have good stuff and bad stuff
pushing
you and pulling you.
So you know, I think to be able to, if you really sort of start analysing those things, you start seeing the good in them as well as the bad in them, unless they are really terrible.
No.
The only good joke in Zoolander 2 is it takes a long time to pay off, is that. Owen Wilson, who's like just, you know, it just looks like he's phoning everything in now. He doesn't care about anything.
Yeah.
It's
a shame because he's a wonderful comic actor.
He is amazing, But he's in a relationship with an orgy, so he's in a relationship with 11 people
or
something.
Oh, that's funny.
But then they all become pregnant. and Keith the Sutherland. It's very much let's have a celebrity instead of a joke, as I was saying to you.
Right.
Keith the Sutherland is one of the orgy people.
Yeah.
And he has his pregnancy test as well, and he's pregnant as well. It's not yet the funny bit. And so it's hilarious because he's a man. Keith the Sutherland is pregnant with Hansel's child.
Right.
There's a spoiler coming up here. I contend that Zoolander 2 writers and directors have already spoiled this film, so it's okay. But at the end, he falls out with his orgy, and he has an affair with another orgy. And it's, it sounds like a brilliant. It sounds good when I'm describing it.
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea. But then at the end, Keith Sutherland comes back, and the orgy come back, and they're all going. And he says, "I'm ready to my responsibility to look after my kids." And Keith Sutherland says, "I lost my baby," and it's all so inappropriate.
That's a really funny line.
He looks really sad.
I lost my baby. I love that.
He's going, it's okay, we'll bring up the other 10. It's just...
If only they put those two little beats on YouTube and just you could not have to watch the film.
Yeah. But it's sort of, it's amazing when you
see... Have you ever seen the Red Letter Media deconstruction of... what's it called? No, not Star Wars. That's the famous one. They did one of the Adam Sandler drag comedy.
Oh, yeah, Jack and Jill.
Jack and Jill. Yeah. And that's apparently extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. I'm obsessed with Adam Sandler films. Yeah. In fact, we talked about them in the last podcast, I think, including Jack and Jill. But yeah, it's amazing. But that's amazing.
You should watch this review. Love it. I mean, they basically accuse him of fraud.
Yeah.
Because they say these movies cost, $50 million to make,
yeah.
And there is like $500,000 on screen, and the rest is shared out amongst all his actor friends. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's a brilliant moment in it where they go in a movie like this, right? The scene you would expect to see would be a scene when both of them are in the same shot. And he goes, but that doesn't happen. He says, maybe that happens once. He says, but that's just They don't. It's too hard to do. They're too. It's going to be expensive. So every single shot in Jack and Jill is shot of Adam Sandler and then shot of Adam Sandler dressed up talking to Adam Sandler because they just couldn't be arsed. They just couldn't be arsed. And Pacino's in it for no reason, going like this at her and her going back. And I guess they assume the audience is going to think that's the funniest fucking thing ever. But anyway, sorry, I'm ruining it. Watch the Red Letter Media thing. It's brilliant. It's really, really good.
But that is, it's almost a sign of, it doesn't, I mean, I think maybe, I've heard the Absolutely Fabulous film is very good, and that is full of celebrity cameos. But it's almost like, I can't think of anything. Get Susan Boyle walking through.
Yeah. No, it is
like
bad.
That. It's hilarious, Susan Boyle's like that for no...
And that joke when people go, "Hello, Susan Boyle," where they say the full name for some reason. It's like, okay. All right, let's move on.
Anyway, don't bother renting Zoolander 2 if you haven't watched it already. Has anyone watched Zoolander 2? Yeah. Yeah? One man. Did you enjoy it?
No.
It was pretty disappointing, wasn't it? I mean, they didn't have... Even if they'd just done a very run-of-the-mill, repeat of the first one. The first one's pretty good.
As I say, I'm 50 nearly, and I don't really have enough time left to be spending even a second watching a film like Zoolander 2. You know what I mean? I mean, you can smell it. You can smell how bad it is before it arrives. I'm really surprised you watched it.
I didn't. I thought it would be okay. I like Ben Stiller, and I thought he would have more self-respect.
Yeah. I just do a quick Google search, see the general tenor of the reviews. Nope, not for me. Because it's really bad as well, critics praising stuff that's not good. That's also a waste of... That's really bad. You see films that have been pumped up and they're just terrible. And also films that are being misrepresented. Like, I used to love a film, Stranger Than Paradise, by Jim Jarmusch. It's John Lurie and this other guy, who's a brilliant actor who you'd know if you saw him. He's been in a bunch of things. And they're just these two kind of beatnik guys, and this kind of cousin of theirs from Russia or somewhere comes in. And it's just really, it's really sweet. It's slow moving. It's long takes. It's black and white. And it's kind of boring, right? But it's nice. It's a nice film. And then we saw on the poster, it said, funniest film of the year. No, it's not, you fucking liar. And what happens is that you go and you have a bad experience because you were expecting the funniest film of the year.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, definitely.
I
yeah.
hate that. Sorry.
But, you know.
That happened on Happiness as well. Happiness. Remember Happiness? Yeah. Happiness. Funniest film of the year. It's not. It's funny, but it's not the funniest film of the year. It's really disturbing.
It's okay, I'm going to ask you an emergency question. I've been copying them off other people now because people copy mine. And so here are some of the ones that I've been that I've nicked. And at least I'm crediting who's nicked them. Lifehacks.io. If you could jump into a pool of something, what would it be?
Chocolate. I don't know what to... Sorry, man. Can you warn me about a couple of these?
No, I'm not this...
I might come up with something good.
No, it's good when you
can't. This isn't going to be as good as the Armando one. Believe me,
if we keep down this road. It's better that you went... Chocolate. That's seeing a great comedy mind at work there. And that is all part of it. MarshallJonesJr.com. Have you ever tried sushi?
Yeah, it's amazing. I only realised how good it was quite late in life, and then I realised it's the most delicious thing in the world. It's amazing because you think rice and fucking fish,
raw fish.
I'm, you know, it's Dr. Steve Brule bit when he eats sushi for the first time. He just kind of spits it out, laughs at the idea of it. I'm not a kitty cat. Anyway, sorry. Dr. Steve Brule is... Are anyone fans of that in here? Yeah, good. Sorry.
Oh, this is a
I don't
new
know
one.
What kind of crowd you are. I can't really see.
This one is a new one I have to ask from last week's podcast. It won't mean much to you, but I still want you to answer it.
Okay.
Who would you rather died, Windsor Davis or Matthew Crosby's wife?
Who would I rather die?
Died, yeah. Windsor Davis from Never the Twain Shall Meet.
Is he still alive,
I think.
Is he still alive? We had him in Paris.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah, you I go. Was so excited. I was so happy about
I
it.
I think he's still alive. He came up last week. I've never ascertained, but let's say he is still alive. I think he is. Or Matthew Crosby's wife. Matthew Crosby is a comedian from Pappy's Fun Club.
Right.
His wife's very a nice young person. She's a very pretty and very talented producer.
This is kind of like if you could save a burning, save a child or the works of Shakespeare from a burning
a little
house.
Bit.
So really,
but, you want me
to say the man who's lived his full life and is nearly dead anyway.
I want to know.
No, I'm going to go for the wife. I'm going to go for the wife.
I think it's probably the right choice.
I felt you manipulating me. I didn't like it.
And this is the one I wrote today. Where do you stand on transubstantiation?
I'm against it.
Are you? Good. So you still script? You used to script doctor for films and other people. Do you do that sort of stuff anymore?
No, it's really hard work to get because I mean, I think you have to. I genuinely am thinking of writing a play. Just so, an original play, just so people will respect me. Because when you're a sitcom writer, you might as well be a fucking birthday clown, you know? As far as studios are concerned, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, this guy, you should try him. He's bozo. He really walks around, he perps his nose, he's got big feet. He's great. Make him do a third draft and we'll be fine. But like, I would usually get children's films. I did. Right. Did I tell you what I did?
No.
I did Agent Cody Banks 2.
Okay.
And you'll like this. I did a scene where all the kids played... war, what is it good for? And the Queen got down. I wrote a scene that had that in it because I knew they'd love it. I knew that they're going to think this is the best thing. The Queen, war, what is it good for? And the Queen doing this. Brilliant. Here's 10 grand. I mean, really, it's the easiest job in the world because that's one reason why I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Because American films... are genuinely often, you know, if they need a writer to come in at a certain stage, are often very badly written.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, some are okay, and also a lot of the heavy lifting has been done. They've got a story with a beginning, middle, and end. You know, that's fine. But the only thing you ever have to do when you do a rewrite is you just have to do the show don't tell thing.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, are people familiar with show don't tell as a concept? Right, okay. So that's what you have to do. Someone comes... No? Okay.
I quite like not doing it, though.
That's a percentage. Yeah. That's
let's not tell them. Let's show them.
That's a percentage of your audience at home as well. We've got to do it. Show, don't tell means if I was writing a scene where I got angry with Richard here, I don't write, I'm very angry with you. I write, I kicked the table, he kicks the table over and smashes Richard in the face. That's showing that I'm angry rather than telling. And that's what every script lacks. It's full of people telling each other the story, you know? And all you have to do is go in and say, well, how do I turn that into a dramatic, you know, moment? And, and it's just kind of easy because, all the heavy lifting has been done.
Yeah.
And it's really lucrative. You get a load of money, you don't put your name on it, and, you know, you do quite well. But, you know, I only get asked to do children's movies and movies set in Ireland. They asked me to do that one... oh God! They begged me to do it. It was a romantic comedy with what?
Leap Year.
Is that the one in Ireland? Yeah, the Amy thingy. Yeah, Leap Year. They begged me to do Leap Year, and I saw the trailer, and there was a line in it.
Is the bloke still in there trying to beg you to do it? It's Leap Year. Will you do it, Graham? Will you do it? Is it out? I don't care. Come back and do it.
But there was a line in it, and they were going, and it was something like, "Wait a second, we're going to have to drive all the way from Wales to Dublin." You know? And I thought, wow, that's what I would have had to do. That's what I would have done on the rewrite. I would have just crossed that out.
You're putting our car on a ferry for quite a long time.
So, you know. I had to start saying no to that type of stuff because the only thing I said yes to recently was I just did a tiny, tiny bit of work, like a day on Paddington. And I have to say, I didn't really realise from the script how charming it would be. I saw the script and I thought, well, this is just going to be one of those... I should have had more faith in Paul, because Paul's brilliant. He does the Mighty Boosh and stuff, you know. But it looked like, on paper, it just looked like one of these quick cash-in, Pudsey the Dog type movies. But it was really beautiful.
Yeah, it was nice,
you know?
Yeah. Well, I'll put that down to you stepping in and turning it around for them. What else did I want?
No, I really didn't do anything. I can't remember what I did. I may have corrected a misspelling.
Oh, you tweeted me to tell you just that you mentioned cryptically your son's text about the bear.
Oh, shit, if I turned off my phone.
Oh no.
I'm going to have to wait for this to charge.
We can fill.
Yeah, no, I'll do that. I'll tell you about the other thing, which was my Twitter joke that I couldn't tweet because, A, it's not really my style, so lots of people would think it was serious, and B, something I'll explain in a sec, but the joke was racists are in a race, all right, a race to the bottom, right? That was my joke. I wanted to do it with the exclamation mark and everything, and... And then I thought, no, everyone's going to think I'm serious for one thing. Because I kind of stopped doing jokes on Twitter.
Yeah,
And the other thing I realised was, you know, I literally had it and ready to go, and I was thinking about it. Well, should I do this? Should I not? And then I heard that a place near us had been firebombed because the family were Polish.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, oh, okay, I can't really do this joke at the moment because racism is suddenly not funny.
Yeah.
It's suddenly not this abstract thing that you can... poke, like the way you and I would often poke a thing like that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you fucking hell, you dressed as Hitler for
years. Yeah, exactly.
You know, you could poke this stuff, but would you dress as Hitler for a year now?
Funnily enough, I did. I'm doing a best of show.
You might get people following you down the street.
Well, I did a best of show. I'm doing a best of show as my next tour. And one of my favourite routines is from that Hitler Mustache show, which is about how racists are actually more liberal than liberals because they believe... there's only four types of people in the world, whereas liberals believe there's 195 different types of people in the world. What? So they're closer to seeing everyone in the world as being the same.
As being the world.
They're 191 closer.
Right.
But than liberals, and that's what we want. And it's quite a carefully crafted routine. But again, it was A, the first time I'd done it for a long time, so I was still trying to remember it. But B, it sort of starts with me going, you know, I got this moustache, and I was worried maybe the moustache was what made it Hitler racist, because I'm not a racist. But, you know, when I had the moustache, I wondered if maybe racists had a point. And usually, you're getting a laugh, and everyone's going, where's he going with this? And then the routine's quite carefully explained, but it uses some of the racist language in it. And and I'm very proud of the routine, but it was a very, very different atmosphere doing it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it didn't work. at all, whereas it always worked before and it didn't work. And I think that might just be now, and that hopefully it will pass. But yeah, it was. I mean, that whole show, I did then a big bit of saying, oh, that whole show was actually about how we should vote to stop right-wing politicians gaining prominence. So that fucking worked.
I think I have this for you now. This is a verbatim text from my son. I checked it with my wife. I know you always see these things online. Oh, my cute son said this, and it never seems to be true. But I checked it with my wife, and I do trust her. So she swore that this was true. He said, his sister, Wendy had a toy panda that she chucked onto the floor, so I picked it up and put it in my bed. I noticed it was on its side, so I put it upright. Then it fell head first. I noticed behind his buns there was a pound. That's it. There's no more. I love that story. I said that we were working with Brona Gallagher, and Brona Gallagher said, maybe it's a money box or something. Which yeah. I thought, no, it's like the bear has had money behind its balls. Sorry, it seems funnier when my wife... Could it be my children's antics aren't as interesting to other people? No, it's the audience who are wrong.
It always is, it always is. I've read an interview that said you were interested in German board games. Is that true?
German, no. The thing is, board games.
Why do you say it if it's not true?
Because I like that without the word German in front of it.
Why did it have German in the interview? Why did it say German board games?
Possibly because it was long ago and it was at a time where the only board games you could get were in German. So
what time was this?
About 10, 15 years ago.
About Monopoly.
Oh no, not fucking Monopoly. These are good games with
what kind of board games do you play?
At the moment I play a card game called Netrunner, which is like a two player game that I play in clubs.
Okay.
with nerds.
Yeah.
And I play there's just some great games out there.
So they're kind of more complicated things than...
Yeah, the problem with them is there's a little barrier you have to get through, which is explaining the rules to people, which people fucking hate. And so it's really hard to get a group together because everyone just hates that bit.
Yeah.
Because you go, no, you can't do that. You have to move the red counter to there unless you want to do that. And then if you want to do that, you have to roll a six, and then you can play that card. Or what do the cards mean? Well... Okay, and it's just terrible. But the thing is, like everything else online, it's all made easier now by videos. You know, you can watch a video. I just send a video to people and say, watch this, and it'll take you through it, and then we can play.
That's good.
It's good, it is good.
I was playing, my daughter's got, who's 17 months old, very cute, I could tell you a few stories about her. She's got her first board game, which is, it's a big dice with all different colours on it. And you roll them, and then you pick up a card, and you have to do what it says on the card. And I felt that was too... I was almost like, oh, this is too complicated. So we started putting together, oh, this looks difficult. But it was easy. You'd have to go red, make a smiling face.
Right,
that was easy. It was actually easier than it looked. My daughter didn't really like it.
There's a beautiful one called Shadows in the Forest, I think it is. Right. And it is a German game. And you play with a tea light, and you put it on... you put it on the board, and there's all these trees, so it casts these shadows as the tea light moves along.
Okay.
And the kids can move anywhere as long as they're within a shadow. But if the tea light catches them, if the light from the thing catches them, they're out. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's just a lovely game. Yeah.
And you still play? I played last time I saw you. We were playing poker with each other.
Yeah,
about a year ago.
That's strange. Idea.
We both got knocked out first. I think we were the best, but we both got knocked out first. That's the problem with poker.
Well, someone beat me. Someone beat me by. This is poker. sorry.
Let's go through the whole thing. But are you still playing a lot of poker? Or just...
No, I used to like playing online, and it seems to have. I used to like single player tournaments or 10-player tournaments and. I can't really do that anymore. I don't really know a good site that allows you to... Is there a good one?
I haven't been playing very much online at all, really, yeah.
There were a few cheating stories that made you think, oh, what are we doing? We're sitting at home thinking that no one's cheating. I mean, this is real money, and of course they're cheating, you know? So...
Yeah, the bubble burst a bit. We did a pilot that was which seemed a little bit too late in the day to take on a poker TV show. It might come back. You never know. Got some free headphones. Did you get your headphones? Did they send you some headphones?
Oh, no, they didn't.
Bad luck. Yeah. Oh, yeah. could have sold them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do like, but I still love poker. It's a
amazing game. Yeah. But it's frustrating because you can be the best at it, as I am, and never win.
Yeah.
That can't be true. All right, it's nearly time to let you go home and do some work, I think. But I will, I'm going to ask you.
Oh, ask me about Count Arthur.
Oh, yes, I was going to ask you about... I will ask... What about
Please
old,
watch it.
What about old Count Arthur, then?
At the moment, I had a brilliant experience. Someone getting off a train who met me. And, you know, it was one of these ones that every time someone says, oh, you know, are you Graham Lennon? And I go, yeah. And they go, this guy went, I'm such a fan. I just love your stuff. And I go, oh, right, you know. Well, he says... And then they go, so what are you working on at the moment? And you suddenly realise there's something about the tone of the question that means I haven't watched one of your programmes since Father Ted. So you know, what are you working on your moment? You know, after Dermot died, what did you do next? And it's like, oh, well, you know, I'm doing the third series of Count Arthur Strong, you know. And this guy, and I said, oh, you know, you should watch it. And this guy goes, is it any good? Well, it's not my sort of thing, but sorry. Actually, that's a steal. I stole that joke from Simon. Simon Thickovitz. Simon. Blackwell. Simon said that someone did that to him once. They said, "Is that any good?" He said, "It's not my sort of thing." He wrote, but yeah, you know, it's kind of. An experiment in seeing if it is possible to write a mainstream half-eight type sitcom that isn't shite.
Yes, yeah. And you direct this as well? Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, you're
doing it today.
Yeah.
I have to rewrite it tonight.
Right. And so you're working on one episode this week?
I heard a story about you. I heard on...
It's not true.
I heard Richard Bowden. My producer,
oh, yes, yeah.
Who was your producer, he said you would not know a story at the start of the week and you would write the whole story in the week and film it on Friday night.
Yeah, yeah. It was something like Thursday, but yeah, on Time Gentlemen, Please.
How are you still alive?
It was difficult, but I was young. I couldn't do it now, but I was a younger man and, right. You know, it was... it was weird because we did I mean, I basically wrote a whole American Star series more or less on my own.
Jesus
And we got nine more in the middle, so it was 13 and then another whatever, it was another nine added on, so that's I had to write insane. 9 episodes in 10 weeks.
Why didn't you try and write 6 episodes in 20 weeks?
Because we didn't have time. Because we'd spent like the first script, I probably spent a month and a half on, and then the second, you know, we worked on about 6 of them to begin with, and we had a series of 13. And then, but literally, we were recording them, and then they said, we want another 9.
Jesus
and,
Christ.
You know, and then there's all these people who then get that 9 weeks more work and all this other
right.
stuff. And
so
the product, you know, and we were getting paid really well for that. We got paid really good money for it. And so, you know, and I was young, and I was kind of keen, and I write, right, and, you know, I think they were good. I think the ones I wrote in a week weren't any better or worse than the ones I wrote.
Really?
Yeah, I think they were, 'cause
I have to have a story. I have to have a really strong story the week... we start. I have to know at least what the story is.
I can. Well, I kind of like discovering the story as I write.
No,
and
that's insane.
Well,
insane.
Well, it's sort of, then you get to something that surprises you a bit, I think.
Absolutely, but then you rewrite it when the thing that surprises you has appeared, and you plant the fucking thing at the start of the episode, so that when it comes, it doesn't feel random. But do you know what I mean?
I
totally agree that there's a spontaneous and but I think there's a kind of happy medium.
Definitely. I mean, writing 1 in a week, or writing 9 in 10 weeks, as I did, is not a happy medium. Mm. I've worked very well to deadline, so it was insane. I was dating someone in the show as well, but I wasn't, so I was completely
that
in the show.
Like an idyllic couple of weeks.
And it was literally all, so basically they would record them on the Thursday, I think. I'd start working on the, you know, I'd finish the last one and then start on the next one on the Tuesday. By the Friday, I'd have something for them to read. Then I'd go away over the weekend and rewrite that. And the Monday, I'd have something to read. Then I'd rewrite it on, and then on Tuesday, they'd have Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday to get
rehearse.
Ready.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we were rehearsing a bit on the Monday as the bits that we knew. But it worked quite, because it was up and running a bit. The second series was really easy to write, and we didn't have any of those kind of problems. We had 15 in the second series. And because you've got the characters all established and you know it.
Yeah,
we were a bit more prepared, but I found it very easy to write them. But yeah, it was... Yeah, I mean, I'm very proud of that series, but no one really ever saw it. So, yeah. But it, you know, it paid for me to have a nice house in London. So there we go, or at least the beginning of a nice house in London. So it's you know, it was. I did like 6 years of work in 2 years, I would say.
Right.
And it was well paid work, so it kind of set me up.
It's funny, I've recently realised that I'm going to have to, for my health, stop doing studio sitcoms soon, because they're so cumbersome and slow. I mean, they're like you rehearse them during the week, which is all fine, and then on the night you got 3 hours to do it.
Yeah.
And if you don't get it in the 3 hours, you're fucked.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you can move a scene onto the next week, but that will create a domino effect, and you'll won't be able to get something further down the line. Yeah. And it's so stressful. I stand there, you know, and every time, you know, like the first time there's a boob, the audience laughs, and you go, "Ah, it's so funny, you made a mistake." And after 1 hour of that, you go, "If he fucking does that again, I'm going to fucking kill him. And stop laughing at him! Stop laughing at him!" You know, it's like that, it's crazy. And I just don't think I went through a period, because we had to write, you know, far less than your output on time, Gentlemen Please, but we had to write 6 episodes in about 2 months.
Yeah.
And they were rewrites. Sorry, I better have some water. They were rewrites, so it was not too bad.
Yeah.
But I still got some kind of shoulder problem as a result, and now I have to see a fucking masseuse every week.
Right.
You know, because the back muscles have seized up. The ones on the back aren't doing their job. And
yeah, I mean, it's incredibly stressful.
And it comes on when I'm watching the show.
Yeah.
When I'm watching it being made, I go like this. By the end of the evening, I'm like the fucking Phantom of the Opera.
But after I wrote Time, Gentlemen, Please, it burnt me out, and then I've never really written anything again since then.
But that's why you should not never. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I do, but you know, I think that's the good thing about being young. I mean, I've sort of got a pilot scripted now, and part of me's thinking, oh God, if they make it, I've got to write 6 of them.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, you're kind of going, oh.
That's how Larry David apparently felt on Seinfeld.
Right.
Every series, he just never thought he could do it again.
Yeah.
But I kind of realised that, you know, one of the things I've always lived by is that if you believe that the well of inspiration is very shallow, it will be. But if you believe it's deep, that will also be true. You know, and as a result, I've been able to, I have to say, rehearsing is now quite fun, because I used to, on a Monday, because you're comparing it to the one you've just done when you've done a week's work on it.
Yeah, yeah.
On the Monday, you read a script that you thought was in great shape and it's just shit.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you put it on its feet and you realise, oh, no one can move. He can't move over there because this thing is happening, so I have to rewrite this so he can move over to that part of the set.
Yeah, yeah.
And stuff like that. And it seems like a lot of work, and it used to really upset me, and I used to go home and I used to work till 4 a.m. and, you know, just really upset, thinking I have to fix this. But then I realized recently that, sorry, this is very technical, I hope it's interesting, but I realized recently we have a whiteboard, and anytime I come to a problem, I write it on the board, and then during the week we just cross them off one by one. So on Tuesday there'll be 9, on Wednesday there'll be, you know, 5 left.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's usually 1 or 2 that you can leave till the night of the show, and there's something about the adrenaline and the excitement of doing the show that these jokes just pop out, you know? It's brilliant. It's such a nice... I'm really enjoying it.
But that's why I get from stand-up, I think, is that I now write my stand-up shows on stage, more or less. I go on with some ideas, but I improvise them, and that's exactly what happens.
Yeah.
That's why I find writing scripts hard now, because coming on stage, you're doing it for a few nights, you'll knock together a routine in a couple of weeks pretty easily, but also... That the power of that the deadline, the very real deadline of being on stage and having to say something means you come up with a phrase or a joke that you could sit down and try and write for weeks and you would never come up with it, and you come up with it straight away. So that inspiration, I still get it from working. I've never, you know, the deadline, I'm terrified of missing deadlines, and I hardly ever miss them, but I have to be very close to it, and then I'll suddenly be inspired and stuff will come out. So it worked quite well for me, that Time, Gentlemen, Please thing. But it was sort of tough, but partly also we just, you know, I for the first time I earned some money, because we'd been doing the double act, and that sort of paid off. That by the end of that 10 years we were back even, basically.
Right.
And then I suddenly had 2 years of really hard work where I earned more money than I needed to live off,
and
it sort of set me up. So I think partly I got to the end of that and thought, why have I worked so hard on stuff that nobody's ever heard of?
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to do, you know. So I had a couple of years where I kind of just, it wasn't really that I burnt out, it was just I was thinking, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know, and I've got some money now, so what's the point? So I bought a house that was too big for me, and then I had to carry on working. It's a brilliant plan.
To pay for the house, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. You've got to keep paying the mortgage, haven't you? Anyway, look, I can see you've picked up your coat, and it's...
Oh, no. I swear to God that was just a coincidence.
I think it's... I'm going to pick up these little signals. The years of doing this. It's been like, thank you so much for coming in without bloody Armando Iannucci ruining it all.
No worries. I'd gladly do it again, Rich, anytime you want.
Absolutely. There's lots enjoyable. More to cover, so I'm sure we will have you back on again. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a round of applause, Graham Linnan. You have been listening to Return to the Square Theatre podcast with me, Rich Terring, and my guest, Graham Linnan. The music's by Pest. Thank you to everyone at the British Comedy Guide, the Leicester Square Theatre, and the Go Faster Strike for helping me make these, especially George, who is very good. You should employ him if you need to record something, but aren't that bothered about it being very good. The producer is Ben Walker. He sometimes turns up. It is a Sky Potato Fuzz and Go Faster Strike production for the internet. Thank you for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.